Welcome to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series, interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today.
Welcome, Eugene, to the Freedom of Thought podcast.
A great pleasure being here. Thanks for having me.
So you're now a professor of law at UCLA. You had a remarkable life before coming to UCLA as a law professor, and I thought we'd just start with that. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, you immigrated to the United States from Kiev at age 7, came to Los Angeles, and went to college at the ripe old age of 12, went to UCLA, graduated by the time you were 15, and during that time, you had run a computer software company. Is that right?
Yeah, my father and I started a small software company that sold, he was the business guy on this, but sold some software that I wrote, and you know, that was my career for that. And also, I worked for some other companies around that time. I worked for Hewlett Packard, worked for some startups. It was an interesting first career to have, an interesting time to have it.
So you were a 12-year-old software engineer, and your father was running the business selling the software.
Right.
That's incredible. So how long did you do that after college?
So I did it a total of, in an active way, of about 12 years, about 3 years during college, and actually started in
so this would be
year,
just 12 to 15.
12 to 15, yeah. And full-time 15 to 21 for 6 years, and then I went to law school, and during law school I kept doing some of the work on that.
And now, my words, not yours, you're one of the most influential law professors in America, particularly in your chosen field of free speech.
Oh, well, that's kind of like one of the tallest dwarfs. Right?
Well, it's a field where, you know, if someone has 500 citations in the course of their career, that is a good career. That was a success. You have almost 10,000. I would say that when you've lapped the field by a factor of 20, it's been a pretty successful run, and it is far from over. You're also a practicing lawyer with an active First Amendment practice, and among other things, you're cited in 15 Supreme Court cases.
So I don't think it's 15. It would be nice if it were 15. I think it was like 7 or 8. I'd need to do a Westlaw search.
Okay,
to confirm
we can
that.
Check my facts.
But a bunch of court cases. Remember, in the academy, he who dies with the most citations wins.
You're ahead of me. What led you to law school? I mean, with this burgeoning career as a sort of computer prodigy, why'd you go to law school?
You know, who knows why we do the things we do? But I think it's because I wanted to lead a semi-public life. I wanted to file briefs in important court cases. I wanted to argue in front of courts. I wanted to testify in front of subcommittees. I wanted to write op-eds. Not clear. I should have wanted that. Maybe I should have wanted something else. But I did want that, and that's what I've got, knock wood. It's, you know, it's not the real public life of being, say, a politician, yeah, which I'm completely temperamentally unsuited to. But it's the ability to participate in the governance of your nation, at least in an indirect way, which is something that I think a lot of people are interested in, and a lot of people, I think, end up going into law and into the legal academy for that. And that's what I wanted, and I guess that's what I still want. I'm pretty happy with the choice I made.
So somewhere in there, somewhere, you know, between 15 and 21, when you graduated from college and were working full-time in software, and 21 when you went to law school, you just had a longing that was unsatisfied by what you were doing.
Yeah.
You wanted to be involved in politics or be involved in public life more broadly.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it's true. When I graduated from undergrad, I thought I'd never darken the door of an educational institution again. I did not much enjoy undergrad. And I was really excited about being a programmer, which, you know, I had continued to be. But, yeah, I felt like I wanted to do this thing as well. And certainly, you know, I talked to a lot of tech people who are techies still, but who are really very interested in policy questions,
yeah,
like I was. And so I think it's a common desire. I think it's a little less common to act on it because it's expensive to act on it. But it worked out for me, I think.
So eventually you wended your way to your field of free speech law. Not your sole field, your primary field.
Right.
Why was that? What was the, attraction?
Oh,
of that
because
as
everybody's attracted to free speech law. It's this glamour field. You know what the important fields are? Employee benefits law, tax law, tremendously important. My wife, insurance lawyer, plaintiff side business insurance lawyer. If you have an insurance policy, like general liability, so somebody sues you, you call up the insurance company and say, no, we're not going to fund your defense. She's the one that call in order to make sure that the insurance policy works. So that's tremendously important. Between these things, literally trillions of dollars, many trillions of dollars at stake in all of this stuff. People's lives. But where's the fun in that? The fun is in the glamour. The fun is in the constitutional law. And for me, I remember when I was a teenager, I was just interested in free speech law. I was reading some cases, like I'd buy a case book in a used bookstore and I'd read it through and I'd think, well, that doesn't sound right to me. Maybe I'm shallow. Maybe a really deep scholar would have went into something really important. But I've been enjoying it.
I have other friends who, when you grew up in your early years, very early years in Kiev, it was Soviet Kiev, right?
Right.
Your parents were shaped by the Soviet experience.
Right.
I've at least known some legal scholars and lawyers and judges from the Soviet and post-Soviet era whose constitutional motivations have to do with that lived experience. Is that true of you? I mean, did you have some formative experience, or did your parents have some formative experience of oppression that made you interested in freedom?
You know, it's hard to tell. Who knows why we do the things we do deep down inside. I will say my parents, when I was growing up, my sense was they were not kind of hardcore, say, free speech libertarians. Among other things, because I think for them, the gulf between this or that issue on free speech in U.S. law was tiny compared to the gulf between any of the positions in the U.S.
Right.
and what was happening in the Soviet Union when they grew up. I think they were open to the possibility, let's restrict this speech, let's restrict that speech. It's rude, it's offensive, it's whatever else. I think everybody accepted, of course, people should be free to express their views on important subjects, but I think they were open to various kinds of restrictions. And I suppose I was too, actually, before going to law school. So it's very hard to tell. I mean, the fact is, we do know that there are lots of people who are super into free speech law, who have very broad views of free speech protection, sometimes broader than I do, who did not grow up in the Soviet Union, did not grow up in Cuba, did not grow up in some other oppressive regime in China or wherever else. So it may very well be that I'm interested and I have the positions that I have just for reasons entirely independent of that. And maybe deep down inside, it does have something to do with something that I picked up directly or indirectly from my parents. It's really hard to tell.
Do you see a connection between your life and your field?
I don't know.
No.
You know, if we had a good scientific approach, we'd find somebody who's exactly like me, except they aren't from the Soviet Union. What does that mean, exactly like, but not? But we'd try to control for that, and we'd see, well, what is that person going to do? Oh, he's going to go and specialize in civil procedure. Well, all right. That tells us what the difference, how the difference in background affects things. But we don't. We don't know. We don't know. Some of the most important decisions we make, you know, sometimes we think we know, but maybe we're just rationalizing it. I don't know.
Well, now you're a professor of law at UCLA teaching free speech, and I'd like to talk about your approach to teaching and scholarship. One of the things I've always admired about you is that you're very clear, but never dogmatic. You're known, I don't know if you identify yourself this way, but you're known as one of the leading libertarians in the law professoriate. But you don't sort of take every issue under the sun and subject it to the libertarian philosophical framework. It doesn't feel like that when I read your writing. It feels like you take issues one at a time and you're sort of ready to reconsider based on a given issue or to think in a nuanced way about how a particular issue works out. I'm wondering if that's something you think about yourself. If at some point you said, I don't want to be a dogmatist. I want to approach legal scholarship a different way. Does it connect to your sense of the best way to be a political thinker or to be a scholar? Could you speak about that?
Yeah. So first, I'm a lawyer. I'm not a philosopher. I don't think I have the temperament to be a philosopher. And one of the things that lawyers are really attentive to is we're not just coming up with answers in the abstract. We're coming up with answers within the context of a particular legal system, which both involves certain kinds of structures. Rights are enforced in particular ways. They're enforced through the often imperfect processes of litigation in front of imperfect judges and juries. But on top of that, you know, there are precedents. There are rules that are set forth. There are text, constitutional text that needs to be paid attention to. So sometimes I say, you know, as a matter of first principles, maybe this speech ought to be protected or ought to be unprotected. But here are cases that say the opposite. And first, I have to be candid with my students in class, my readers on the blog, my readers in my articles, and say, you know, under these cases, this is what the result is. A second, you know, maybe those cases have some wisdom to them. They don't fit within my philosophical ideas, but maybe it's my philosophical ideas that are wrong, and maybe the precedents are right. So that's one reason why I think the answers are often don't fit some theory that I have. But on top of that, the world is a complicated place, and one can certainly endorse big picture ideas, while at the same time recognize that they play out in complicated ways. So freedom of speech, really important. Where I'm for freedom of speech. But, you know, presumably if somebody comes up to you in a dark alley and says your money or your life, that's just speech. He hasn't yet taken your money. He hasn't pulled out a gun. Maybe he doesn't have a gun. But that can't be constitutionally protected. And sometimes people say, well, that's conduct, not speech. Okay, but why? It's just saying things. The thing that makes it harmful is precisely that it communicates something. It's true it may be an attempt to reach a particular tangible consequence. He actually wants your money. But at the same time, a lot of speech is an attempt to produce a particular tangible consequence, which is get people to vote for some law or get people to stop doing business with some company whom you're urging them to boycott and so on and so forth. So, well, I think the right answer is not all speech is fully protected. There's got to be an exception for true threats of illegal conduct. Well, okay, well, how do you define that exception? And what other exceptions might there be? So, for example, throughout American history, there's been an exception to free speech and free press protection for defamation. For today, it's understood as false statements that damage a person's reputation, and often knowingly false statements, or at least negligently false statements. That isn't how defamation has always been understood in American law. It used to be understood more broadly. But throughout American history, at least that has indeed led to liability. Are there free speech problems with that? You bet. Even if you conclude that false statements of fact lack constitutional value, obviously the threat of civil or criminal liability, you can have criminal libel prosecutions, criminal defamation prosecutions. That threat will certainly deter people from saying even things that are true or things that are opinion, because they're afraid that some prosecutor, some plaintiff, some judge, some jury is going to say, well, they're defamatory. So that's one reason the Supreme Court has cut back on libel law, on defamation law, but it hasn't completely eliminated, because at the same time, you know, we do want to provide some deterrence to lies that ruin a person's reputation, deprive him of his livelihood. Those lies are bad for the target. They're bad for the listeners. They're a form of fraud, essentially, because even though the most direct effect is on the person being talked about, presumably if somebody stops doing business with him because of a lie, you know, they're losing out on important business opportunities. They've been essentially defrauded of that option by the defamer. And also it's bad for our democratic decision-making, that if constantly we're being lied to about the qualities of this candidate or that candidate, it becomes much harder for us to come up with sensible decisions about whom to vote for, whom to trust in daily life and the like. So the world is a complicated place. And it's rare to have a legal principle which admits of no exceptions. Even something, I mean, killing, obviously, it's bad to kill people. Well, except in self-defense. Okay, well, it's just self-defense, but not just in self-defense. What about capital punishment? Well, you might say, I'm against capital punishment. Okay, but would you prosecute the executioner in a state where it's perfectly lawful for murder? Even if you're against capital punishment, right. You would say, you know, this right. person's just doing his job.
I've got to tell you, I am temperamentally suited to philosophy. I have a philosophy PhD as well as a law JD. And one of the things I've always loved about law is precisely the way it forces us out of our philosophical absolutes or our philosophical dogmatism and presents this series of very nuanced, concrete situations and legal resolutions to those nuanced, concrete situations that ultimately, I think, have a lot of wisdom to teach our first philosophy, that have some sort of instruction to give. So we can sort of, instead of imposing our philosophy on the law as often as ever, law is philosophy's teacher. Law makes philosophy more nuanced.
Well, so one of my favorite lines is from Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, and not from a free speech case, he says, abstract principles do not decide concrete cases. Yeah. And when I first read that before I went to law school, I thought, that's awful. Like, what's the point of having an abstract principle if not to decide right. concrete cases?
What does decide concrete
right.
cases?
Right. And then what I came to appreciate is that the abstract principles at a high level of abstraction may guide things in particular a direction, but there are often multiple abstract principles that point in different directions, right? Mm-hmm. So there's freedom of speech, but at the same time, people should be protected from being harmed by others' wrongful behavior. Well, is that just punching? Well, no. For example, libertarians say, well, you should be free to do anything you want so long as you don't use force or fraud. Okay, well, what counts as force? What about having a nuisance? What if I, for example, have a pig farm next to your home?
It
is
sounds
that, is
like
that
these,
force?
It sounds like these nuances just interest you. You enjoy them.
Well, of course I do. I think I would hope all law professors enjoy them. Likewise, what is fraud? Is libel a form of fraud? Is fraud limited to situations where, which we think of as fraud, which is knowing lies? Or what if I say something about someone that's negligently false, but is still false and then ends up damaging the reputation? Does that count? And that's even for libertarians who try to have a very, very simple set of simple rules to guide their lives. I don't think the set should be quite as simple. So then you have all sorts of other questions that arise that become very difficult to resolve. And that's why we lawyers get paid the big bucks. maybe two big bucks. But it's in part because the world is a complicated place. And it's rare to have a really simple, crisp rule that covers everything.
I think we're not supposed to say the bucks are too big in public, right? That's supposed to be just between, no. We are with your examples, you're starting to get into some interesting free speech fundamentals. And a lot of our audience for this podcast are non-lawyers. So I thought it would be interesting to unpack some fundamentals of free speech. So forgive me while I ask you questions that are sort of what I teach undergraduates as well as law students, and I'm going to try to imagine some of the questions they might present and see how you respond. So in the American tradition, our free speech law starts with the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, passed immediately after the ratification of the Constitution itself. It's part of a deal between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And the text in many ways you've spent most of your career working with is, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. I want to start with this. How did the founders think about free speech? Why is it in the Constitution? What's the history and what's the thinking behind putting it in the Constitution? I guess one way of saying is, what did they think they were protecting and why?
Well, so it's a very good question, and nobody has, at least to my knowledge, a really comprehensive and clearly correct answer. And part of the answer may be that they didn't really know exactly what they were doing. Just like today, people can genuinely be committed to basic principles, but not only disagree with each other about what those principles mean, but not have fully thought through what all those principles could mean. As best we can tell, at least as best I can tell, the Constitution consists of a few things, very important things, that were meant to be a radical breaks with the old regime. Obviously, Republican government rather than monarchical government, although by the time of the revolution, England had become a constitutional monarchy where the king had actually quite limited power and Parliament had the bulk of it. They believed in separation of powers that were quite different, although in some measure reminiscent in some respects of the English system as it had evolved. So actually, maybe as to the structure, I should have said, they did think of very considerable changes. Although some of the things were borrowed directly from England, right? Two houses of the legislature.
Yeah.
So their abolition of aristocracy was also a very important break. But in the Bill of Rights, generally speaking, it is thought that those were not intended to be breaks, by and large. Some were, like not having an established church.
Mm.
Of course, England had and still has an established church. Many of the colonies had it. The framers deliberately decided not to have it, at least at the federal level. But when it came to things like freedom of speech, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, freedom from excessive fines, those for the right to keep and bear arms, those they thought were basically the good old rights of Englishmen.
Forgive me, they thought they were codifying an existing English right, the sort of right of an English citizen included the right to free speech.
Right, they thought that they were codifying it, and by putting it into a written constitution, they thought that they were putting it on a more secure footing. They realized that in England, speech was not as free as they might like, or the press was not as free as they might like, although, of course, it was freer than almost anywhere else in the world. And I think they probably appreciated that for all their quarrels with the English government, there really was a lot of free speech and free press in England and,
sure,
and in the colonies. But they thought that they were basically securing that on a firmer footing. And one thing Akilah Moore at Yale, I think, pointed out very well, not only did they in the abstract believe in free speech, they had just conducted a revolution that, while of course was an armed rebellion, was founded on free speech. What had happened is the American colonists had debated their grievances against the government through speech and through the press, and they came to the conclusion that they needed to reform their frame of government through the revolution. And to the extent that they managed to do that, it was through debate. It was not because somebody on high, some new king, gave them a better solution. It was because of democratic debate. And then they reformed the system they first set up, the Articles of Confederation system, with the Constitution. And that was without any force of arms, really. That was just through debate. They just gathered and they talked about it, and there were articles in the newspapers, and that they thought was a great success of what? Of the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press.
In a sense, freedom of speech was the traditional rights of the English, but the whole founding of the country was a freedom of speech founding.
Right.
It was a case in point. The Declaration of Independence was a set of grievances against England, against the king. The debate over the ratification of the Constitution largely unfolded in the form of op-eds and pamphlets,
exactly,
between the Federalists and Anti-Federalists. It all took place in the course of, you know, sort of democratic deliberation.
Right. So people have already remarked, I'm not saying anything new to legal academics, but that one of the most important words in the First Amendment is the freedom of speech or of the press. They weren't talking about some abstract concept of freedom of all speech. They were talking about a particular right that they believed they had, subject to various constraints.
Yeah.
I think all of them would have said that does not include the right to defame people, again, to say, at the very least, false things that damage someone's reputation. probably most of them would have said it doesn't include the right to engage in obscenity. So highly sexual by their standards, which are not perhaps not that sexual by our standards, statements. They may have actually thought the same with regard to blasphemy. It's an interesting question, which also is complicated by the fact that there was so much religious diversity within the United States. So there were various things that they never, to my knowledge, really thought about. I don't know, for example, about any cases having to do with threats during that era. But it was well understood, I think, that this is supposed to be very broad protection, but also limited protection in certain ways. And then there were a lot of things that weren't fully understood, like how much, to what extent is it sufficient to say this is going to be basically enforced by juries? So if there's going to be a prosecution for something, that's fine, so long as there's a jury. What we really are upset by is by so-called prior restraints, mm-hmm. by administrative licensing schemes where you need a government license to use a printing press to publish a newspaper, or by injunctions, which one judge, who is an agent of the government, institutes. So it's not completely clear to what extent they thought that the jury would be, which of course is also secured by the Bill of Rights and by similar provisions in state constitutions, would be sufficient. Likewise, just a few years after the First Amendment was enacted, comes the Sedition Act of 1798, which is just shows that nothing new under the sun. 225 years later, we're having similar debates. We just talk about fake news. Mm-hmm. And people say, look, if you can spread fake news about the government, if you can cast doubt on the legitimacy of elections, that's going to cause disaffection on the part of the people. That's a very dangerous thing in a republic and may lead to insurrections and rebellions. Well, that's exactly the argument for that we see. There's actually a couple of opinions. There was actually a statement by Justice Iredell to a grand jury, and then the statement by Justice Chase to a trial jury, which say exactly those things, that are saying, of course, freedom of the press is tremendously important, but surely that can't include the right to spread malicious falsehoods about the government. Because if people do that, not only is it false and malicious, but it's going to lead to rebellions, which in fact they had just seen rebellions happen based on what they thought was the government being lied about. So, and at that point, there was this sharp debate among the framers, or I shouldn't say among the framers, among people in Congress, who actually overlapped very little with the first Congress. It was a different set of people, but very much still linked to the founding tradition, some of whom were big supporters of the Sedition Act of 1798, roughly the Federalists, and some who were opponents, roughly the Jeffersonians, let's say. So everybody, I think, said we believe in freedom of the press. It was mostly about writing, so they probably would have focused more on freedom of the press. We believe in freedom of the press, but what is the freedom of the press? Does it include the freedom to libel the government? And some said yes, because the alternative is to leave it to government agents, including prosecutors and judges and even juries, to decide what's true and what's false about the government, and that's too dangerous. And others said, well, the dangerous thing to for a republic, especially a young one, is to leave people free to lie about things. So that's one of the difficulties. It's hard to tell because agreement on, again, the abstract principle doesn't necessarily mean agreement or even having fully thought through concrete cases.
So when one contemplates the freedom of speech tradition from this broader perspective, it's an ancient tradition. I think of Milton's Areopagitica, or Mill's On Liberty, both English texts, and then the sort of branch of the same tree that is the American tradition of freedom of speech, and gets underway with the events that led to the First Amendment, the sort of democratic deliberation at the founding that led to the First Amendment, and then gets new life with each ensuing controversy, including, mm-hmm. as you pointed out, the Sedition Act. This tradition continues into modern times, and there's an active area of scholarship, which I think is more than most areas of scholarship, joined by judges. There's sort of an active discourse among lawyers and judges and academics and indeed philosophers and others about what the basis for the right of free speech is. A series of justifications are offered. They're different from one another, and the justifications have implications for how to understand the right to free speech or the right to a free press. and how to resolve particular doctrinal disagreements. Can you take us, I'm sure this could take a week, so let's say briefly, could you take us briefly on a tour of some of the major justifications for freedom of speech and talk to us as well about which one you think is true or which one most resonates with you?
Yeah, so people have talked a lot about this, especially law professor people. Judge people have focused less on that. They've focused more on precedents. But of course, law professors say, well, how can you understand the analogical force of a precedent unless you understand the theory behind it? There's truth to both of those approaches. So law professors have basically identified several. Let's just focus on the principal ones. One is democratic self-government. And certainly there was a lot of talk about it throughout American history, including around the time of the framing and before, which is if you're going to have a democracy, it's not enough just to have people vote. Because how do people know which way they want to vote unless both sides can tell them, well, here's why you should vote in our favor. And not just during the campaign, but in the years coming up where people can say, you know, we want to change the law with regard to transgender athletes and women's sports teams. Change it in one direction or the other direction. Well, we could have a vote, like, for example, in my state of California, you could have that be an initiative. Or you could elect politicians who are going to vote in a particular way on that. But how can we decide that unless throughout the years before the election, people can say, well, here's why, yes, you should allow transgender athletes and women's sports teams, or no, you shouldn't. So that's that. The theory there is the heart of the freedom of speech is democratic self-government, and you need to be able to express all sorts of views, including really awful views, including views that you don't think that the voters should go for, because the point of a democracy is that people should have the right to choose that it shouldn't be, that the right choices shouldn't be dictated for us by somebody on high, or even by past Congresses who say we forbid these particular statements because we don't want to change things. Rather, they should be, every generation, every batch of new voters should decide them anew. And even things that are proposals that are unconstitutional, you know, the Constitution has a mechanism in Article 5 for changing it. So I'm certainly not a fan of slavery, and it would certainly be unconstitutional to enact slavery in the U.S., but, you know, the 13th Amendment was an amendment, and it could be another amendment. And as a matter of democratic principles, all issues need to be on the table, especially since you can't really trust the government to decide what is good and what is bad. We ourselves can make that decision as voters. And at some point, you know, if slavery is reinstituted, we'll probably have another civil war. And that happens too. But that isn't something that some government should say no, because we know this proposal is wrong. We're going to forbid you from making. That is a departure from democratic self-government. That's the democratic self-government theory.
Okay, so democratic self-government. The thought here is that freedom of speech is the precondition of democratic self-government. So we have to protect it as part of our commitment to democracy itself. Let's call that justification number one. What's justification number two?
So the justification number two turns out to be pretty similar. And in fact, a lot of these justifications are similar and lead to similar results. And that's what sometimes is called search for truth or marketplace of ideas. So here's one way of thinking about it. If you talk about democratic self-government, what about somebody who says, you know, I want to be able to express my views about the theory of evolution? Now, the theory of evolution may bear on democratic self-government. At the very least, it bears on democratic decisions about what we should teach in schools, right? But fundamentally, the reason we want to be free to talk about theory of evolution is not primarily, I think, about democratic self-government. It's that we value truth in all sorts of subjects. And by truth, I don't necessarily just mean objectively determinable scientific truth, but also moral truth, that slavery is wrong, that free speech is good, or something like that, where these are truths we want to talk about. Religious truth, too. Now, maybe that's covered under the free exercise of religion clause, but in fact, a lot of recent cases on religious speech have dealt with it under the free speech and free press clauses. So, and we want that for its own sake, but we also want it for instrumentally, like much of the prosperity and safety that we enjoy stems from scientific developments in science and engineering. Mm-hmm. By the way, the developments in government are also important to make sure that we can really take advantage of those scientific developments. And to produce more such scientific developments, but those scientific developments are tremendously important. And the freedom of speech includes the right to talk about those things. Why? Because of the search for truth, because we want to have a marketplace of ideas. Not that the search for truth will be perfect, because after all, a lot of speech undermines the search for truth. And not even outright falsehoods, but just theories that are unsound or opinions that are bad ideas or whatever else. But the theory is that that's the most reliable way, having more free speech, is the most reliable way, albeit not a perfectly reliable way, to arrive at the truth.
So let's call this number two, that right. The marketplace of ideas supports the discovery of truth.
Right, right. And freedom of speech is necessary to have the marketplace of ideas right. Really function. So the third theory is about self-expression. So, you know, it's not about some end goal of democracy. It's not about progress. It's about people being free to convey their most basic views. And I think one clear example of that is in the religious speech context, that I think one thing that we think, even if we are not religious ourselves, like I'm not religious, I don't think that religious advocacy is going to advance the search for truth much, although I have to keep open the possibility that maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is a God and he wants me to do this, this, and that. If so, I'd like to hear about it. I'd like to know about it. It's not enough that I hear about it. I hear a lot about it. I'm just not persuaded. But on top of it, you could say, look, just people should be free to express their views. People should be free to wear symbols that represent their religion. It's just important that people be able to convey that. It's important that people be able to express their views on political subjects, not because it advances politics, but because that's something that is a central part of our lives, of our lives as humans, to be able to talk about things that are important to us. Obviously, one of the main things that makes us different from other animals is, as best we can tell, the other animals can't communicate the ways that we can communicate. We have, in fact, probably evolved our big brains, at least many people theorize, precisely so we can better communicate, so we can better work together. So humans have a desire for communication, and that is a fundamental moral right as a result that they have. So here's an example of something of a case where the theories, I think, do play out differently. So New Hampshire has a state motto, live free or die. And it has that, I believe still does, on its license plates. Well, some Jehovah's Witnesses, the Maynard family, didn't want to display that on their cars because they thought that that suggests kind of an attitude towards secular matters, even secular matters as important as freedom, that is contrary to the supremacy of God. That was their view. My guess is most people don't think much about the motto on the license plate. But the Supreme Court sided with them in a case called Woolley v. Maynard. It said, you have the right not to have your car be used as a mobile billboard for a viewpoint you disapprove of. Mm-hmm. And the court described it as a matter of your freedom of mind. Well, but if you think about it, it's not like that mandate really interfered with democratic self-government. I mean, sure, it was the government kind of conveying its own views on your car, but it's not like it changed people's votes. And of course, you were perfectly free to put up a bumper sticker saying, I don't agree with right. Live free or die. It's not like it undermined the search of for truth. Again, you might say that if the government kind of participates too much itself in the marketplace of ideas, it can unfairly skew that. But of course, the court has said, you know, the government is perfectly free to express its own views in lots of ways, including the way that does skew things is public education, which is government speech that the government is free to engage in. So really, I think what was going on there is a sense that your right to self-expression includes the right just not to have this property that's closely associated with you can be used to convey a message that you disapprove of. It's all about the Maynards. It's all about them and their selves. It is not about some broader instrumental goal. So that's self-expression. And there's one other theory, which is actually plays a role in at least the first two, probably all three. Some people
just, just to put a pin in the third theory, can we summarize it as freedom of speech is a facet of human freedom more generally? It's part of the self-expression that lets us communicate who we are to each other.
Right. But the argument there is, first of all, it's an especially important facet. And it is perhaps a facet which is more deserving of protection, maybe because even when it is harmful, it harms through a particular way. It harms by persuading people generally. It harms by communicating things to them rather than, you know, myself. I might want to kind of have the liberty to punch you. After all, that's the liberty for me to use my fist. It's part of my body. Or, but that has a different kind of harm, a more direct harm that we might think should be more regular. But it is an important question for self-expression theorists. Why is this any more important than conduct that people want to engage in? That's not speech.
So now we're on to number four.
Number four, which may in fact be a very closely related to one and two, or maybe part of the explanation of one and two. And again, maybe even of three. And that is that it's not about the value of speech. It's about our unwillingness to, or not about just the value of speech, or even primarily about the value of speech, although of course, if you're gonna protect speech, you have to think it has some value. But it's about our unwillingness to trust the government with the decision of what kinds of speech, and especially what viewpoints, ought to be suppressed. So the theory is the government has all sorts of self-interested reasons to try to suppress particular views. Generally speaking, that whoever is in charge is going to want to suppress views that are contrary to his views. And it could be a particular politician, or it could be a party, or it could even be the majority. The current majority might want to suppress views that are contrary to theirs. They, by the way, may be very sincere in their views that those are really harmful. Really, the main harm may be to their political power, but it's human nature to view threats to your power and your status in society as threats to the social order. So because we think that that's particularly dangerous, we don't want to give the government the power to discriminate, say, based on content or viewpoint of speech. Now, of course, you still have, again, the question, like, how is that different from other kinds of conduct? Because the government can, of course, restrict economic relations in all sorts of ways in order to protect the people in power. And by the way, restrictions on economic power may affect politics in the future as well. I mean, I think it's not uncommon for whoever is in power now to try to promote the economic interests of their group and not of their enemies, in part because the wealthier they get, the more likely they are to retain power because they'll be able to deploy their economic power for political purposes. So you know, each one of these theories has possible objections to it. What's happened is the Supreme Court has never committed to one or another. The Supreme Court has said, look, here are these cases where we think that there ought to be this kind of protection, and there are some cases where there ought not be protection. And it is sometimes appealed to one, sometimes to another. And it's not like these theories are mutually exclusive. It's not like if you believe in self-expression, it means you cannot logically also believe in the value of democratic self-government. And maybe even they're sometimes mutually reinforcing. So the court has never settled on one theory. It's drawn arguments from both, from all of them. It's drawn arguments against speech protection at times from all of them. And so we get kind of a complicated, bumpy sort of system of legal rules, which may reflect just the complicated nature of the world.
So which one of these, if any, resonates the most with you? I realize that they're not mutually exclusive, and so you could potentially affirm multiple or all of them.
Right.
But I have to think that after many years with this material, one of them feels like the most important of the various truths that they all might capture.
Right. I suppose I'm mostly kind of on the search for truth, democratic self-government side. Those theories are very closely linked because, among other things, for democratic self-government, presumably you want the ability to learn the truth about things. I've been somewhat less interested in self-expression theories, but I've gotta say that there is, I think, a lot of force, certainly in some of the precedents, a lot of force in support of the self-expression theory. And again, there could be complicated connections. So for example, I've been working on and off for years in this article based on a Solzhenitsyn essay. It was the last essay that he wrote before being expelled from the Soviet Union in 1974. And it was published in the Washington Post. The English title is Live Not by Lies. Mm-hmm. And his claim, and he's not a legal theorist, he was a political thinker. And a political thinker, but a very concrete, with a very concrete agenda that he was trying to accomplish. His theory is that people should, as a matter of kind of their own moral judgment, refuse to participate in distribution and creation of what they think is a lie. And he would have very much supported, I think, the position of the Maynards about the live free or die. If you don't agree with that, you should just refuse to have it on your car. And why? Well, he said, it's because having to say things that you believe are false saps you of your self-respect and saps you of the respect of others because they know that you are willingly telling the lie. And it makes you a less effective political actor that and perhaps rightly less effective, that people won't listen to you anymore. Even when you say something that's true, they'll say, wait a minute, isn't that the guy who was willing to endorse the lie the other day? And that in order to really be, to bring government back into our hands, in order to perhaps search for truth about moral issues and political issues, we need to be cleansed of that, cleansed of complicity in the lie. So his claim is this, very much a self-expression one. It is all about you and your right and your duty not to lie. But at the same time, he says it's tied into those other things. I think there's a lot of truth to that, too.
And Solzhenitsyn was he wasn't just a political thinker. He was a freedom fighter against the Soviet government at its very worst.
Exactly.
And he was reflecting, right. I guess we could quibble
at
about
its second
very
worst.
At its second worst. And when he was, presumably reflecting on the kind of oppression that the Soviet Union was engaged in, sort of making people affirm that which they believe to be false mm-hmm. at the cost of their livelihoods mm-hmm. or well-being or even freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like you start from the marketplace of ideas, search for truth kind of justification. But there are tendrils of thought radiating outwards from there to the democratic self-government justification or to the self-expression justification. And ultimately, you're, I don't know if the word is agnostic, but you think none of them maybe has such a stranglehold on the truth that the other should be disaffirmed.
Yeah, I'm open to the possibility that maybe it turns out it really is best understood as this one theory. And any cases that are contrary to that just are, therefore, we have to recognize are wrong and should be overruled. You know, it's possible. But I do think it's not surprising that the court has appealed to all of them at various times, because I do think that they reflect important things about human nature, important things about human society.
Thank you for listening to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today. To learn more, visit freedomofthought.fedsoc.org.